This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Even his own, like, family
members. Does Ted like Ted?
I think even Ted Cruz doesn't like Ted Cruz.
Yeah. What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome back my special guest for this week, Dale Chu. Dale, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back, Mike. Thanks.
Dale is one of Fordham's senior visiting fellows. You don't visit much these days, though, Dale, given the pandemic, but we should change that to senior Zooming fellow. How do you like that?
Sure. Whatever works like.
Sorry. And an independent consultant on education policies and programs. Among other things, you are running a great website for the Collaborative for Student Success. What are you guys calling that again?
Called Assessment HQ.
Assessment HQ. Welcome, David Griffith, my co-host, as always. Welcome, David.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
Yeah. So, Dale, you know, we are mostly going to talk today about reopenings. Last week in the Education Gadfly, you and I did a little good cop, bad cop routine, as Andy Rotherham pointed out. I got to play good cop. I always take the good cop role as a common practice. I put various other people in the bad cop, you know, you, Checker, Robert. I love putting Robert in as the bad cop.
It's a question of gravitas, Mike. Bad cop takes a certain amount of gravitas.
Jay Green for a while. I enjoyed putting Jay Green in as the bad cop. But anyway.
Mike, you're a cockeyed optimist, Mike.
yes. Well, we'll talk about that. But hey, speaking of Assessment HQ, big news this week. The Biden administration saying we are not going to accept across-the-board waivers. States are going to have to test. This is good, right?
Yeah, I think reason for cautious optimism. I mean, certainly for Biden and his team to stand firm in face of the opposition. I think certainly credit where credit is due. At the same time, I'm under no, you know, illusions about sort of how close we came to a Secretary Lilly and also the nominee for Deputy Secretary. And then looking at the letter from the feds themselves, you know, it seems like towards the end, there's the line about, you know, working with each state to provide additional flexibility, which sounds good. But at the same time, that strikes me as a crack that you could potentially drive a bus through. So we'll see. I mean, it's going to depend on how the feds respond to these waivers as they come in.
Yeah, no, this is all well said, Dale. I mean, I think that the first articles about this, especially from Chalkbeat, made it seem pretty clear that, okay, you got a test and yeah, the test could be shorter and figure out a way to do it online for the kids who are at home, or you can even move it to the fall, which is something that we at Fordham have proposed, at least in states where lots of kids are still learning from home right now. But then a few days later, EdWeek comes out with an article that says, well, some states think maybe they still could get the feds to sign off on them not giving the state test. You know, for example, say, well, if local districts are using the map or the iReady or the Star or something like that, then we really
Here in Colorado, it's funny, like one of the legislators that's pushing the bill to cancel the state test, her reaction to the letter from the feds was actually positive. She said, actually, if you look at the letter, it doesn't say that you can't apply for a waiver from the state, from the state assessment. So this is not to be too cynical, but like the idea with Cardona, I kind of feel like there was a little bit of the, you know, have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
With this letter, there's sort of element of that as well.
Success. I'm sure the Biden people are like, perfect. We nailed it. There we go. All right. Hey. Well, to be continued, I suppose. But the real discussion today is back to, of course, what it's on everyone's mind, at least all of us parents, when our school's going to reopen. Now, let's talk about that in today's Ed Reform Update. All right, Dale. So last week in the Gadfly, you made the case that basically, Biden really needs to start getting tougher on the teachers' unions if we're going to have any chance of reopening schools. In these holdout states and districts, you know, the big blue states on the West Coast and plus Maryland, a few others, plus many of the big districts around the country that are still fully remote, even today. By the way, that includes my own kids, Montgomery County Public Schools, though they say it really looks like they are going to start opening up in March. My kids may be back in a classroom at least every other week, starting in April. So there you go. Your daughter, in the meantime, in Colorado, has been back in person 5 days a week since August, except for a few quarantines. So, lucky ducky are you. Share the argument here, Dale. What else do you think Biden should be doing, or why do you think he's getting rolled by the unions right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that Biden just has to get a sort of a straighter spine and stand up to the unions. My piece was more the argument that that's not what Biden is going to do. It's more that the unions have had a very clear aim in mind in terms of this is an opportunity, a once in a generation opportunity with a pandemic to get a financial and political windfall that they would never realize in any situation, another situation. And so this ultimately comes down for them as an opportunity to add more members, right? When they're saying, well, if we want smaller class sizes, that means more teachers, which means more union dues. You know, the idea of the federal government providing this money is certainly a much more easier path for them than, let's say, try to fight this battle in states where it can be a little more difficult. And so the unions have this, you know, have had this strategy from the beginning since last March, and they're pushing through with it. And if anything, the current state of play, I think, benefits them. And as much as we like to sort of complain about the unions, and or certainly I like to complain about the unions, they're actually acting coldly rational about everything.
All right. So you're basically saying that they're trying to hold a hard line and, you know, hard bargain with the president, with the new administration. And what they want is a huge amount of new federal funding on schools, right?
Which, that's right.
They appear to be about to get through this next relief bill, that, you know, $1.9 trillion relief bill. Well, we'll see what the final number is, but sure looks like it's going to include in the neighborhood of over $100 billion, maybe close to $200 billion for K-12 schools, which is a huge infusion. They can spend that money over the course of the next several years. At the same time, that's not, you know, the permanent increase in Title I, for example, that Joe Biden promised on the campaign trail. And you talked about in your piece, you know, tripling Title I funding. I mean, this is still somewhat temporary. And school districts would be nuts to use this money to, for example, hire a bunch of new people or agree to hire teacher salaries, knowing that the money's going to go away a few years from now. So, I mean, I guess I see your point, but they're going to get more money. All right. So let's assume, though, fast forward 3 or 4 weeks, that bill passes. We finally then see all of a sudden unions, even in the blue states and cities, say, OK, time to go back to school.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like it'll be interesting when we get to that bridge and cross it. Because, you know, let's say we get to the fall and, you know, the package is there, the money's there, you know, take all the excuses off the table and see what the union says. And I'd like to think they would say, okay, yeah, now we can go. But here's another angle to all this, Mike, is that as much as, you know, Randy Weingarten, Becky Pringle, you know, they sort of wax eloquent on the various, you know, things that need to happen in order to get back to classrooms, ultimately they have, I mean, the power is local, right? So a lot of this stuff that's happening, I mean, I, you know, as much as I get, it's fun to punch on Randy. I mean, it's at some level, she's almost as powerless as any of us. I mean, in all this, which is kind of frustrating as well. But that's just the reality of it.
Yeah, well, no, that is exactly right, Dale, that she's powerless. And even President Biden is largely powerless, right?
That's, I mean, right.
And look, this is what I argued in my post, was that he's playing a game here, not a game, but he's using a diplomatic strategy.
I mean, he's also behaving rationally, Mike.
Well, he's also behaving rationally, right.
You've got a difficult public policy issue, yeah, where, yeah, there are clear, horrible trade-offs. Any politician worth their salt is going to aim for the middle and try to appeal to both sides.
All true. And so Biden is basically saying, I mean, his line is, hey, schools need more money to reopen safely. I'm going to get them the money. Okay. And so, and I assume behind the scenes, he and his people are making it clear to the unions that they better get on board once that money comes through. And the question is, what happens if it doesn't? I mean, you look out in California, you got Gavin Newsom, you know, who is a progressive, maybe not quite as far left as the teachers unions out there, because it's really hard to be as far left as those teacher unions out in California, but still very progressive. He put $2 billion on the table, you know, same basic strategy. But he's now gotten into the position where he's very publicly fighting with the unions, and which is not a place he wants to be. And again, it what tends to happen then is that the unions decide, hey, they like a good fight. You know, that shows that they have value to their members. And so then we have more delays in actually reopening. So I just think that for Biden, he's got to, in public, keep his arms wrapped around those teachers unions and say, I'm with you. I understand your concerns. I know your members are nervous. We got to protect vulnerable teachers and get them vaccinated. Or if they've got vulnerable people in their homes, we got to worry about that. We got to spend the money to make schools safe. I mean, look, I think you and I both agree, Dale, that a lot of this is overkill. I mean, that you know, you can open, especially in elementary school right now, quite safely in most parts of the country, especially if you've got some kids opting to be home full time. And so you can take any teachers who are vulnerable or their families are vulnerable and protect them. I mean, this is doable. Now, it doesn't help that the districts that have to pull this off are in some cases totally dysfunctional. You know? And so the teachers don't trust that they're actually going to manage this well and protect them and make it fair. But I don't think that Biden had any choice. I guess I'm saying, I mean, for all the Republicans and some of the other reform types who are saying that Biden should be, you know, is getting rolled and he should be pushing harder and he should be screaming at the unions. My argument is that would not work. And if anything, that would just make the situation worse.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think that's right. It would work. I mean, in terms of Biden's tactics, you know, we want to keep you safe, you know, I want to engender trust with you guys. I mean, for me, I go back and forth. I mean, I think that lines requires a little bit of suspension of disbelief, right? I mean, you think about, you know, the billions of dollars they're talking about putting on the table again, right? We know sort of the previous billions of dollars, they haven't all been spent yet, right? And then whatever this package is that comes down the pipe, it probably isn't actually going to be spent until 2022.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
These private schools have been open. My daughter's school, the charter school, has been open. I mean, it's just kind of like, wait, what's going on here, right?
Yeah. I suppose the red states that are not exactly well-funded have been open, yeah.
Yeah, but when we look forward towards education recovery, whenever we get to that point, and tutoring or what, in that scenario, I'm much more on board in terms of, hey, there is a big fire raging in our house. And when there's a big fire raging, you know, you don't just say, hey, let's just sprinkle the water here, here, and here. You spread the water because of the fire. And so I get that idea, but I'm still largely skeptical, as you know, Mike.
And look, I agree about the money. The money is part of the diplomatic dance. And look, the money will be spent on recovery. And I think that's okay. The kids are going to need a lot of help. At the very least, we should talk about, hey, maybe the next school year should be supersized so that it goes well into the following summer. That's one strategy. That's going to cost money. Tutoring's going to cost money. Hey, all those supplemental educational service providers from way back when, man, they need to get rebooted because there are going to be billions of dollars on the table. You can imagine that Joe Biden is going to give the privatization sector and movement a new lease on life here, Dale, ironically enough.
I think the question, I mean, for me is, what do we ask for in exchange? I agree with everybody. The situation is unprecedented. And even in normal times, I have a hard time arguing against more funding for education, even though I also think that we need, you know, structural reform so we can make better use of the money. But I think the question that we're all struggling with is, what are we going to ask for in exchange, right? Because we ought to ask for something. We ought to not just shovel money out the door. We ought to ask for something, a longer school year. What is the best way to actually spend this money? Because it is. It's more money, as Dale said, than you actually need to reopen schools. And so what is it actually for?
But what you were saying, David, is what worries me in a lot of this, right? Like, what are we asking them to do, right? Like you said a moment ago, like, you know, school districts would be nuts to, like, you know, spend this on stuff that, you know, can't sort of last in perpetuity beyond this sort of temporary funding. But we saw from, you know, the last recession, that's exactly what happened. People were talking about funding cliff. And what happened? You know, down over the cliff we go. And so, like, it just seems like this is going to be exponentially magnified. You know, I love the idea, you know, federalism, we're devolving, we're letting decisions being done at the local level. Folks are going to be able to use, you know, creativity, local ingenuity to spend these dollars. We shouldn't be so, you know, restrictive. I mean, as a conservative, I'm there. But the same thing, there's a huge tension between that and sort of this impulse. It's hardwired to the DNA of the system. It's just to get more people. And we know that's not a sustainable tack, but this is sort of something we see over and over again whenever our system runs up into, you know, with these calamities.
So let us be thankful, circling back to our discussion at the top, that testing is coming back, that we're going to be able to start measuring again which schools are making progress over the course of the year and which are not. Let's also be thankful that ESSA includes that requirement around fiscal transparency, so that we will have some sense of where this money is going. And if and when districts waste it, which, you know, many probably will, at least we will be here to call them on it. All right. Hey, Dale, that's all the time we've got today. But thanks so much for coming on. I hope you'll come back soon. Dale Chu, Fordham's senior Zooming fellow in the flesh.
Thanks, you guys. Good seeing you.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
You know, of course, our audience can't see this because we just do audio for our podcast, but we are now, you know, using Zoom when we tape these. And so you can see, Amber, I'm growing a beard here. I'm trying to go for the Ted Cruz look. What do you think? Is it working for me?
Hey, you know, I like Ted Cruz, so I know everybody doesn't.
Wait.
Whoa.
You like Ted Cruz? I mean, I think even his own, like, family member.
Does Ted like Ted
I think
Cruz?
Even Ted Cruz doesn't like Ted Cruz. Yeah.
You pitched it up for me, Mike. What can I say?
I knew it. Nah, I'm just teasing. Woo-wee. What a week he's had, huh? I tell you. Boy, you just can't take a vacation anymore, huh? Boy.
I thought you were going to talk about my decor, but went somewhere else. But
what, your decor hasn't changed? No offense, but I don't see any difference in the.
No, place. I know. I just thought that's what you were queuing up for our listeners. But I like your segue much better.
All right. Yeah, we'll see. This is about where I always give up on the beard at about this stage. But I don't know. Maybe since I don't actually see almost anybody in person, I can persevere this time.
Right. It's like a goatee. It's not really at the beard stage yet.
You just can't see it. There's hair on the sides. It's just white. It's all white. That's
a goatee sounds so much more chic than beard to a woman.
Is that right?
And that concludes our research minute.
Is there a study on that, Amber? Do you have evidence?
What are you going to bet that that's going to be the little piece that Dran edits out to put at the top of the segment?
It would be a good one. All right. Well, what do we have this week on the education research?
All right. We got a new study that examines the impact of test-based accountability on young children. It looks at an initiative in North Carolina to turn around its lowest performing schools. So this is, you know, some of these generation of studies we saw about accountability just coming out now, but I thought it was a good refresher. It looks at 2015 to 2017, whether the initiative impacted the various outcomes of young children, which we don't see as much, as well as the assignment of teachers into untested grades. We've seen some of this before, but again, a little bit new here. The North Carolina Transformation Initiative, or NCT, designated the lowest performing schools based on test scores as turnaround schools. They received these turnaround services from 2015 through 2017. So extra support, services, needs assessment, school improvement planning, leadership coaching, instructional coaching, so on and so forth. When they were identified, they use a regression discontinuity design, estimating the effect of being just below the cutoff score for assignment to this NCT initiative. So the state had enough funds to serve 75 low-performing schools across the state. They wanted half of them to be elementary schools, since elementary schools comprise about half the schools in the state. So there are 35 grade K-2 schools that are the focus of the study. If you care, they find no evidence that the state manipulated the cutoff score that I just mentioned, and the assumptions of the RD design were met. Then they look at four outcomes: early literacy using the DIBELS early literacy assessment, reading comprehension using the TRC reading comprehension assessment. To my mind, both of those are formative measures. They look at chronic absenteeism, which is where the student is absent for 10% or more of the enrolled school days, and grade retention, which is whether the kids are retained in the same grade for a second year. They also examine descriptively whether this NCT initiative was associated with teacher grade level reassignment. The results: the NCT initiative produced negative effects on early literacy and reading in the first year of the program, but they saw a rebound. It was followed by positive effects in the second year, in the neighborhood of 0.08 to 0.09 standard deviation for both the early literacy and the reading comprehension measures. Next, in the first year of the intervention, the NCT schools had higher chronic student absenteeism, around 3 percentage points higher than the control schools, and higher grade retention, about 4 percentage points higher. The grade retention effects were concentrated in kindergarten and first grade, and the effects of chronic absenteeism were also strongest in kindergarten. No effects on either one of those outcomes in the second year of the NCT. And then, just so you know, because I was like scratching my head how they calculate a value added for K-2 teachers, but apparently when you're in an untested grade in North Carolina, your effectiveness score is calculated by your kid's TRC reading comprehension score, that measure I just mentioned. And so they find that low effectiveness teachers in tested grades across the full sample are 1.7 times more likely to be reassigned to untested early grades. Yet, the NCT schools did not do this more often than the comparison schools. Moreover, there were no highly effective teachers of tested grades in treatment schools who moved to untested early grades, meaning the treatment schools were retaining all of their highly effective teachers in the tested grades. Analysts seem to want to make the case that this turnaround initiative had unintended negative consequences for student learning. I mean, I just went back and looked at it all again. I was just flipping through the pages. I think that's true in the first year, but there's definitely rebounding on all those academic outcomes in year two, and there's null effects on these other outcomes in year two. So I don't think this accountability-driven reform wasn't all that terrible in this particular study.
which is important because a lot of these studies have been finding disappointing results, at least at scale. But as I recall, there's been some successful turnaround efforts from that era in California, maybe it was San Francisco, in Ohio, maybe in a few other places. But when you look writ large at some of the national studies, most of it washed out. So
yeah, we only have, again, this is just 2 years, so we don't know what's going on in year three, but.
What's your sense? I mean, is this, do we see this in a lot of studies that the first year of implementation, you can see declines?
Yep. Or improvements, right? It just seems like there's a shock in the first year either way.
Yeah, that's interesting. What I'm wondering is we just have to accept that you're going to see a little bit of a J curve, so to speak, that you're going to have an early decline and then it's going to come back up, and you just got to make that investment and be willing to do it. Or if there's some reforms that, you know, don't have those first year costs as much.
Yeah. I mean, Mike, this is what makes research and policy tough, right? Because, you know, you would expect some sort of return to the mean anyway, right? The more years out you get, the more stuff is changing, right? The harder it is to connect the dots to whatever they actually made them do. But yeah, at the same time, it's totally unreasonable to expect immediate turnaround. So how do you know when it works?
Yeah. Yeah. No, and look, as our listeners know, I mean, we would probably say that the major alternative to trying these turnarounds is just to grow high performing charter schools. But even there, you know that for kids, at least in the first year that they switch schools, there's also oftentimes a decline in achievement for them. You know, there's transition costs. But I would argue that the investment is probably more worth it on the charter school side, that long term. We seem to know how to scale up high performing charter schools more so than how to turn around dysfunctional district schools. And it seems to have a bigger payoff long term.
I guess politically, why you have to have a turnaround? I guess my question is, do we really think turnaround is the right lens, right? I mean, why is it preferable to just gradual improvement? In the real world, not that you can necessarily track gradual improvement that well either, but most things that I know that work well or that improve, it takes time. It's complicated. It comes together. I don't know.
But not for the very worst. Not for the very worst.
That's called status quo. Oof.
Yeah, and status quo has got to go, David. Come on.
Yeah, I'm not defending the status quo, but you know, turnaround doesn't work, right? And I mean, even in this particular one, it's like, okay, well, it recovered in the second year. I guess my point is, if it's going to take at least 3 years, is it even a turnaround? Why not just simply say, well, we need to see some gradual improvement in the next 3 years, right? Would that really leave us in a different place?
It depends on the definition of turnaround. In this case, it was a bunch more school improvement plans and yada, yada. We know that in some cases, it's a little bit more intense, you know, in terms of ridding staff and that sort of thing, which people don't like that either. Mm-hmm. But it can be a bigger, quote, turnaround definition, you know, in terms of its implications.
It's like firing the coach in soccer. I get that. You're trying to get some sort of psychological shock to the system. I guess I'm just wondering, other than replacing the principal, if it really makes any more sense to fire half the teachers in 1 year than to replace the half of the teachers over 5 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And look, and to the sports analogy, if you've got a team that's sort of mediocre, but not terrible, then yeah, incremental improvement makes sense. Same with schools. I think we do poo-poo the idea of incremental improvement too much. That things like implementing a high quality curriculum and working at it year by year to help teachers learn how to teach it is the kind of thing we should be doing at, you know, for schools at the 25th percentile of effectiveness, let's say. But for the very worst schools, the question is what to do for those. And look, if we had the political will to just shut them down and replace them with high quality charter schools, that'd be my preference. In some places, you have to at least give the college try at fixing those schools. That's okay. But we got to acknowledge that a lot of times it's just not going to work. And eventually, if an organization is so dysfunctional, then sometimes the best thing to do is to start fresh.
Put it this way, Mike, if there's a fine line between defending the status quo and incremental improvement, I think there's also a fine line between turnaround and just churn.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. And yes. Unless you're going to actually shut down the school, I think we shouldn't turn our school around every 2 years.
Yeah, we'll be too dizzy. Okay, well said. Good stuff, Amber. Hey, we like those studies from the accountability era. So
that's right. Will we ever have it again? Maybe.
Good question. All right. That is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli. Thomas P. Fordham Institute.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.